back, pulls up the three, boom, knocks it down. Curry from the corner at three, puts it in.
For overtime, makes it, Garrett, Murray.
It's a warm welcome from me, Mark Woods, to this edition of the MVP cast, which features one of the most colourful characters, I guess we could say, to grace the BBL in recent times, a true basketball journeyman who stopped in Cheshire for a season, but who's seen plenty of the world and many, many things en route. But he still carries that New York City swagger wherever he goes. He is, of course, John Coffino. Welcome to the MVP cast, John.
Mark, long time no talk. It's good to hear from you, man.
You too. You're back in the UK, back in Cheshire. Is this some kind of secret scouting mission, or are you in these talks to come back to the Knicks?
No, I'm sorry. I wish I could give you some juicy, rumors, but I'm passing through to go home for the holidays. You know, I'm going to go to New York and LA, and you know, it worked out where the ticket was very reasonable. Instead of going through Hong Kong or Dubai, I went through England, and I said, you know, let me come here for a week, see a couple of games, see some friends, some fans, and that's all it is. It's just a personal social call.
It's nothing like a long weekend coming up to Christmas in Ellesmere Port. It's good shopping, I gather, somewhere near the arena.
Yeah, that's true, and I'm finally above sea level, so that's I'm happy.
People in this country remember you best from, I guess, what we could call one of the most colourful spells in the BBL of recent times when you were in Cheshire in 2014, 2015. I'd like to come back to that, but let's talk about your current job, because it's pretty nice. You're head coach of the national team of the Maldives. How on earth did that happen?
Yeah, well, you know, most jobs happen when you least expect it, in my opinion. I was, you know, sitting in my apartment in Tbilisi, Georgia, and working at Zaza Pachulia's Academy and an international school. And an agent called me and said, you know, there's a job opening for a national team. I said, well, you know, that's been one of my dreams. And I said, I don't care if it's in Siberia. And the agent said, well, it's a little far from Siberia. It's in the Maldives. I said, what? Are you kidding me? A paradise and a national team? It's like two of my bucket lists. Knocked off in one shot, you know, so I got lucky, you know, and I got down there and, you know, we did some work and I'm almost finished there.
What's that like? I mean, population 427,000. It's not a FIBA region I know much about. What's the caliber of the play of basketball there?
It's not very high. I got there and watched the practices. They, you know, they play hard and they enjoy the game, but, you know, football's number one, cricket's number two, and maybe table tennis is number three. But I didn't have a player over 6'3". And the team was already put together before I got there. So I just had a couple weeks to get them ready for a South Asian tournament in Bangladesh. So we went to India and trained a little bit and then went to Bangladesh and played four games and did pretty well, you know, for what we had and how much time we had together. And unfortunately, half my team got sick, you know, from the food. But it was. They played hard. The guys played hard for me, and that's all I could ask.
I mean, you've had a truly globe-trotting career, and I mean, you mentioned there the Zaza Pachulia Basketball Academy. You were over in Tbilisi for over a year. I mean, what did that involve, being at an academy that's, of course, is so heavily backed by Zaza, who's currently playing for the Detroit Pistons?
Yeah, it was. The first year I worked there, I was just a coach while I was coaching a professional team in Georgia. And then I got a job in China and I had to leave. Then a year later, one of Zaza's main managers called me up and said, listen, Zaza wants you to be in charge of all the coaches and teach the coaches how to coach and like an American kind of style and really rid them of all these bad habits that they have. And so I came in and I laid down the law and I put them through some courses and structure. And that's what Zaza, you know, he wanted. And he was pleased with that. And we had over 800 kids when I was there. And I'm sure they have over 1,000 by now.
I mean, I remember speaking to Zaza a few years ago about the passion that he has for his homeland, about developing not just basketball, kind of opportunities for the kids there to maybe follow in his footsteps. I mean, you heard from him from time to time. What was he like to deal with in terms of being a supportive character for you?
Yeah, you know, there's people there that are jealous of him, and there's people there that love him. You know, of course, now that he won two championships, they all love him. But with Zaza, when I went home to Los Angeles, Golden State was in town to play the Clippers, and we went for dinner, and then he gave me a couple of tickets for the game and back, you know, locker room passes. It was really nice. But we talked about the state of Georgia basketball and what he wants to do. And I have a funny feeling when he retires that he's going to probably be ahead of that federation. I mean, that's just a guess, but he has that kind of that vision, and he wants to really improve the basketball. I mean, he played on a national team for many years, and you know, he's really interested in the youth development from the grassroots level.
What's it like infrastructure-wise there? Because obviously we kind of have mixed views of Georgia. Most people don't know anything about Georgia as a place. I mean, how does that compare as an infrastructure to what we'd find, say, here in the UK?
Yeah. I mean, obviously UK has better facilities and stuff like that. But Zaza's place is phenomenal. I mean, they got three floors with beautiful basketball courts. Eight locker rooms. They have a woman that does all the uniforms. Everything's ready. But he's an exception. He was given that building by the government, so he didn't pay for it. But it's a beautiful facility. They've done a great job there. But most of the gyms there are really not at high standard. And but basketball wise, you know, it's funny. People have asked me, "Oh, how's England and everything? That's not too good, right?" I go, "No, you're wrong. You know, England is so underrated." People don't understand it. Maybe the salaries may not be high, but the basketball it might be better than Georgia. I mean, there's some good players in Georgia and some tough big guys, but I take England over Georgia right now for sure, as far as, you know, overall leagues, the two leagues comparing, you know, both leagues.
I mean, having been to lots of different places, and obviously you can compare the different systems to different places you go, and obviously money is an issue in some countries that you've been to. Money isn't an issue in some countries where you've been to. What from just an outsider coming in, was the thing that you thought was best about British basketball, and what was the thing that maybe needed the most work, needed the most help, change, you know, shaking up?
I think that British basketball definitely has to look at their grassroots level, and also what they have to do is really put a lot of money into their development of not just the players but the coaches. I'm not saying the coaches are poor. What I'm saying is we all need to develop. You know, I'm still developing. When I was in Georgia, I wanted all the coaches to get their FIBA licenses, to go to do courses every year, to go away to other leagues and experience how other parts of the world, you know, approach the game. I think England has to have that kind of investment, and it's no slight against them. It's just an observation, but the thing that I like about the British basketball is that there's a lot of passionate fans here. There's a lot of young fans that love basketball, and I think, you know, because you cover the NBA, that's part of it. I mean, it's amazing where I go around the world how many people watch the NBA, you know, through the internet, on the computer, all that stuff, on TV. It's just incredible that the following that American basketball has. And you know, I think England has a really, they'll never be number one. The basketball never will be a number one sport. You know, we have to stop trying to catch football, but they could be a good solid second sport. And I think, you know, I think they, people want that. I don't see people stepping up, you know.
Where did that passion for you, growing up in New York, and you still got that New York accent, that swagger, where did that passion for basketball for you manifest itself?
Yeah, I mean, growing up in the Bronx, I never saw any haggis there. You know what I'm saying, Mark?
I recommend the vegetarian version. I really can.
I heard that. I got to try that. No, you know, growing up in the Bronx, I grew up in a tough Italian neighborhood. And, we had a schoolyard where I hung out, and we had 8 basketball courts, and it was great. I mean, I just fell in love with basketball since I was 5 years old. But you know, when you have a lot of courts, it attracts a lot of players, and people from other neighborhoods came, and from the African American neighborhoods they came, and the Spanish, and my friends were very jealous, and they were racist, and they tore all the rims down, you know, out of spite, and they spited me, you know. So they said, oh, you know, if you ever want to play, we'll put up a rim for you, you know, we'll do it up. And I was so mad at them, so disappointed, and I had to go to their neighborhoods and play. So I just loved the sport, and I didn't care who played. It didn't matter what color you were, and you know, I mean, it's just I wanted to play. I played from early in the morning to late at night, and you know, when I played in junior college, I played for a great coach, and he made me a coach, and I owe him everything, you know. And it's just it's a story, a storybook that I hope doesn't have an ending for a long time. But my career really started from a very, very young age, and basketball really kept me out of trouble, you know, when I could have ended up in jail or worse.
How much was that a kind of divided city in a way? Because I guess you think of Italians in New York, you still think of them retaining the love of soccer. Baseball's probably more of an Italian sport maybe then. Were you kind of an outlier going in as an Italian-American kid going over to a different, who don't want to play?
Yeah. I played all the sports when I was a kid. We have 4 seasons in New York, you know. So I played hockey. I played football in the winter and baseball in the summer and basketball all year round. There are some divisions there and in different neighborhoods and cliques. And, you know, we had an Irish neighborhood, an Italian neighborhood, and, you know, it was all kinds of, but sports was the common denominator for everybody. And it brought people together. But it was something that thank goodness fell into my life, because it's been my passion for the longest time. And you know, the Bronx was known for, we produced a lot of good athletes. And I don't know, it's just one of those things when you have a lot of, you know, you have a lot of football pitches here in England, so a lot of kids grew up playing soccer. We had a lot of basketball courts. That's just it.
I mean, you've been lucky, I guess, in basketball's taking you far away from the Bronx and getting you to different places, different experiences, places. I mean, you've coached in Kenya, Qatar, China, and that's just among a list. I mean, what places and experiences stand out for you from that journey?
Yeah, I mean, they're all unique in different ways, and some and very similar. But you know, going to Kenya was an eye opener for me. I mean, to coach there and win a championship and live really a hard life, you know, as far as having no electricity or water at times, and couldn't finish a game because they couldn't get the goats off the court. It was just a great experience. And because of that success, that's how I got the job with the Phoenix, through Robbie Pierce, and I was very fortunate. I've been very, very lucky, and you know, I mean, I've had an adventurous life, but to tell you the truth, I'm getting a little tired of traveling. I want to settle down somewhere. I want to build a winning culture, and I want to go somewhere where I could really just lay my hat and just finish my career somewhere.
I mean, you said about Kenya, you coached in, I think it was called the Duncan's Academy.
And yeah.
When you were there, you had a young player, Nuriana Murali. We read about her, that she was one of your most promising players, went to a shopping mall, hostage situation, and didn't come out alive. I mean, to be in charge of a team, particularly a young group of players, how tough was that to kind of not just be just a coach, but be someone who could help them through that?
Yeah, Mark, that was the worst day of my life in coaching. And it's, you know, obviously, like you said, it's beyond basketball. It's comforting all the teammates and the people in the school. You know, besides coaching at the academy, I coached at the International School of Kenya, boys and girls, and she was one of the poor kids that were killed in the mall massacre with her mother. And there's no way to handle it. You know, you just have to be there for the kids. And you know, basketball was the furthest thing from our minds. And to know someone personally that's happened to, it's just even to this day, it's just tough to swallow. I mean, she was the sweetest kid, and I wish I'd never had to go go through that, but unfortunately there are some bad people in this world, and you know, she wasn't bothering anybody, and in fact she was of the Muslim faith, so she shouldn't even have been messed with by those terrorists, but she was, and we all miss her, and then it's not even a basketball issue, you know, it's just someone you have to be there for the kids.
I mean, did that ever make you think, just get me on a plane out of here, I don't want to go back overseas, I'll try and find a college job or a high school job or D-League job, and, you know, I guess aim for that sort of safe, familiar option there?
Yeah, I mean, my family wanted me home right away, and, you know, it's funny, Adrian Woj, you know Woj, called me up and asked me if I was coming home, and I told him I wasn't, but you're right. I mean, there's been some places where I just wanted to go home, but basketball kept me there. Basketball allowed me to forget about all the other, you know, negativity that was going on around me. You know, it's crazy. I mean, it's just been, you know, from China to Spain to Georgia and all these places all had different things, and you're constantly adjusting to the culture that you're in, and it's at times you do miss home a lot, but you get used to it, unfortunately, and then I'm actually looking forward to going home this time.
Going to a place like China, and I guess that same applies to the Middle East or whatever, yeah, there's still that I guess outreach work, I guess, that American coaches do. You're almost teaching the game in a sense to people who are still, I guess, still trying to learn about it. I mean, is there still, do you think, with even with the internationalization of basketball, is there still a mythology that comes with being an American coach arriving in another country where you have things to impart to them that they want to know?
Yeah, you know, they respect you. They want you to come in. They want you to build up the level of basketball, but they never fully accept you. You know, it's interesting. I mean, Steph Marbury is somebody who actually I coached when he was a kid, and he's made a name for himself there. But it's very rare that you go in there and you really become beloved. Now the players will all play hard for you. You know, in China they'll play hard and they'll go through a wall and you'll fall in love with them, but you're never fully accepted. You're not one of them, and you have to know that, and you have to understand that your job there is just to do what they want. You know, you have to do what they want. Unfortunately, sometimes they want you to lose because they bet the other team, so that was not fun, you know? So, but, you know, you have no control over that. The referees do, but it's something that they all want to learn and be like the NBA. They watch so much video and YouTube and all this stuff, and they get the wrong idea. I mean, but, you know, it's just, you have to adapt. You have to adapt and teach them what you can. And you know, if you can make them better, that's great. But a lot of times, especially with China, you have these barriers with the language, and you have even with interpreters, it's not an easy job.
Does that make it difficult sometimes when there's an expectation level? They're watching NBA clips and you're coming in and they almost want you to turn them into the next Steph Marbury or even the next Yao Ming or the next Michael Jordan or whatever when you arrive?
Yeah, I mean, I tell you, the one thing that I learned about the Chinese basketball culture is they don't stop. They practice three times a day, all year round. I mean, it's crazy. That's why they pay these teams to come in and play them, because, you know, when their season is not going on, they need competition, and then they all want to be the next superstar, and, you know, some people want to go to America, you know, they want to go there and play there, but, you know, others are just happy to stay close to home and make a living. But yeah, I think this, you just develop bad habits while watching so much video and try to be someone you're not.
You were assistant before all this at three Division I schools in the States, Iona, Niagara, St. Peter's, all in the MAC conference. I'll ask you about the job in a moment, but we had a few schools from that conference over in the UK just last week at the Belfast Classic, and it's putting NCAA basketball in Europe really for the first time. Is there a product there maybe that we're not paying attention to that probably we should, as whether you're a basketball enthusiast or even the casual basketball fan?
Well, you know, I think the teams that went to Belfast were like mid-majors. I think Maris went there, right? Did Maris go?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think that there's a lot to be learned. I don't think you're missing anything, but I think, you know, college basketball is fantastic in America. I mean, it's just, you know, I like coaching in college. I paid my dues as an assistant for many years, but I love the action part of NCAA basketball as a coach because you're constantly doing something. There's no downtime like there is in the NBA or D League, stuff like that. You work, man. You recruit. You're doing academics with the, you know, players. You're working them out individually. Weights, practice, games, scouting. There's so much to do, and it is so much put in. And it, you know, these guys are on scholarships, so they have to have that kind of commitment. But I think it's great that the schools from America come over and make international trips and share and see how structured college coaches have their teams. It really is, you know, you can learn a lot because compared to the teams that I've seen overseas and the teams that I work with in the NCAA, I mean, there's a big difference.
Do you think there's still, even at the big programs, and we're talking your Dukes and North Carolinas,
but do you
still think those programs, particularly for one-and-done guys, but even for four-year, even sometimes five-year players, does that prepare them as well for the NBA or even top-level European basketball as they would get for being at a top program in Europe, or Real Madrid, or Gran Canaria? I mean, is there an equivalence there, or is Europe still, if you're playing pro like Doncic, and then coming to the NBA, are you still more likely to be ready coming from this side?
Yeah, I think personally that I think guys should stay in school for many reasons. You know, not just developing their game, but developing their bodies. You know, when they get to the NBA level, it's crazy. You know, it's the travel and the demands they have on them physically, and you know, it's something that they need to put the time in. You know, they go for the money. I can understand that. You know, they need money and everything. But I'm for one that you really have to develop yourself physically and basketball wise. And you know, to go over to Europe and play, I'm not so sure how much they're gonna, you know, they're gonna develop, you know, physically, where they would get the same attention in America, in college, where they have a weight program and then now they have nutritionists and dietitians and all that. But, you know, they'll play a lot of basketball, you know, but it's a hit or miss when they go overseas to try to, you know, skip school and say, all right, I'll go there, play for a year or two, and maybe that'll help me. It only helps you because you're using the rule to skip college and make some money and then try to get drafted. Doncic is a huge exception. These guys have tremendous talent.
I mean, when you're an assistant job at a D1 school, obviously there's a lot of the game planning and the helping the head coach in a game situation and scouting, etc. But there's also that recruiting part of that. And I guess people only see a very small slice of that. But when you've been out in the road in the past, I mean, how competitive a game is that? And what's the kind of secret to succeeding at it?
What do you mean? The secret to
recruiting, like getting that kid that you want to sign for your program.
Yeah. I love recruiting. You know, it's funny. When I was a young recruiter, I had a long talk with Franny Fraschilla, and he said, "Oh, you know, everybody likes to recruit, but not everybody gets the players." I guess the secret is to be yourself and to speak positively about your program. And to show the person that you're going to be committed to them, and be true and honest, because there's so many recruiters out there. It's become such a cutthroat business where there's negative talk about, you know, other programs. And I was just honest with guys, and if they felt comfortable with you, they were going to sign with you. I mean, if you it's all about impressions, and you know, you can't sell them a bill of goods that, you know, you're not going to deliver. Say, you know, you're going to start, and you should never tell somebody they're going to get minutes or do this or do that. You're going to earn it. And there's a way to do it now. Times have changed with social media and what you can do and all that stuff. But to me, you got to be yourself, and that's all you can do. And just tell them about your program and what your vision is.
How much has that sort of experience help you when you've been out coaching pro teams overseas, particularly when you've not had huge budgets to work with, that you've had to effectively the GM as well, and you've had to go out and pitch players who might not know about your program? I mean, is that a useful skill that you've acquired that's helped you later on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's pretty similar. I mean, you're really selling. You're selling yourself, and you're selling your program, and you're trying to make them see that they're going to be a part of what your plan is. I think it's very similar. I think being a recruiter for so many years in the NCAA has really helped me. You know, as far as doing that, and when you're overseas, but in the D League, you just drafted people. You know, that you did your homework and you drafted who you wanted, if they were available. But overseas, it's pretty similar to the NCAA. I mean, you're trying to get players to sign with you, and basically that's it. So, you know, it's you sign and we pay you, and hopefully you help us win, and you know, and there's more contracts to come down the road.
What team you had in Cheshire? 26-10, you went that season. You're fourth in the BBL. You had guys like Taylor King, Damone Watt, Julius Hodges. I mean, that was a great recruiting situation, and it worked very well for you. I mean, after one year, though, how do you kind of look back upon that season?
Yeah, Mark, you know, I have nothing but love for Cheshire and the fans and the club. They gave me a great opportunity. I had a great experience. I felt like I made some mistakes. You know, it was my first year in the BBL, and I learned a lot. But I did make some mistakes that I regret and that I would do over. And you know, but I feel like my job was incomplete. You know, Mark, and everybody knows that I would love to coach again in the BBL. And there's no secret about that. I really want to come back here and settle down somewhere and coach a team that will accept me for who I am, and I'm a very passionate guy, and I have a lot of contacts with players, and you know, we had some high profile players. Yeah, you know, I mean, when you have high profile players, they demand a little extra salary. I mean, that's the bottom line. But I think it's just a misnomer about me. I mean, I'm not an expensive coach. I just want to coach. I money doesn't define who I am. I take less just to put more money in the recruiting budget. But I had a great time in Cheshire. I mean, people here are great. That's why I came back. I wouldn't have come back. I mean, to here to say, you know, spend some time here, and it was just an unbelievable time. I'm disappointed that we didn't advance, you know, to the finals. You know, we just missed it, and I thought this season was semi-successful, not totally, because we didn't get any silverware. And so it was an incomplete year, but it was a great experience.
I mean, you've spoken to London Lions in the past. You were down to the final three for the Glasgow Rocks job before Tony Garbellotto took that one.
Yep.
I mean, what kind of appeals to you about here? Is it the language? Is it the ease of the whole thing? Is it the potential of this league? What's the big selling point?
I think I like the competitiveness amongst all the teams. I mean, even this year, I mean, there is no, it used to be a two horse race, right? You know, with Leicester and Newcastle. It's not like that anymore. I mean, I just think that the structure of the league, you know, it has some flaws, no question, but the familiarity with the language is definitely a factor. I mean, it makes your job a lot easier. You can focus on just basketball and not worrying about, you know, what if I say this or that, although we do have some different meanings of our words between U.S. and England, but I like certain clubs. There are certain clubs like Glasgow was a place I dreamed of coaching, to be honest with you, Mark. I really love the situation there. They have a nice arena. They have a great support group. The fans are great. You know, the ownership is obviously, you know, wants to win. And, you know, that was one of the places I was really, really impressed with the interview process. They brought me in, and, you know, I mean, to lose to Tony Garbellotto is nothing to cry about. I mean, he's an established coach, but you know, that's a type of place I'd like to work in. You know, a place that has a good support and a good foundation.
Before we let you go, I've got to ask you one thing about Cheshire from that season. One of my favorite but most curious tales since I've covered the BBL, Julius Hodges was there with you for 3 months. You guys were, I think, sharing a house. He leaves at New Year. The locks were changed on the house. How crazy was that a situation in terms of, you know, dealing with a player or a player being dealt with by a club compared to anything else you've dealt with before?
Yeah, I mean, I had Dustin Salisbury there and Taylor King there, and it's hard. It's not easy. You know, I didn't want to do it, but, you know, we had no choice. And, you know, the negatives about, you know, when you have share accommodations with players is, you know, you're tough on them in practice, and now you got to go home. And face them and like, hey, you know, you were really, you know, they look at you differently, and it's hard to draw the line and the distinction between coach and roommate, you know, and it makes it a little difficult because you really can't be friends. You could be friendly, but you can't be friends because you have to sometimes be tough and discipline, be a disciplinarian to them. And if one of the players does something that, you know, is, you know, out of the ordinary, you have to deal with it. And now you have to live with that person. It's almost like being in a family atmosphere, like when you fight with your family. It's tough. It's not easy. And I hope I never have to go through that again. But we had no choice. I mean, we only had a couple of situations, houses that we had to deal with. But, it worked out. We didn't have any problems. We stayed out of each other's way. I didn't want to see Julius's business or Taylor's or anything like that. I tried to stay away from their business, and I wanted them to stay away from mine. You know, so we had a mutual agreement.
And there wasn't a rota for, like, doing the dishes and cooking and laundry and stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, I cooked for them a little bit. We had a lot out. But they had their friends that they had here, so they were busy, and you know, it was okay. Luckily it worked out, because you know, you have to draw the line, you know, between basketball and personal life, and because it can really come back and haunt you if you have an issue, because sometimes some guys don't know how to distinguish between coach and friend.
You're finished with the Maldives, or finishing with the Maldives. What's next?
Well, I'm a free agent, and I'm looking at a bunch of places overseas and some in America. You know, I got some irons in the fire, but I'm open to anything. I'm always open to listen to things. And there's a bunch of leagues that haven't started yet that I've talked to teams already in Asia, which, you know, if I can avoid it, I'll avoid it. But if I get the right situation, I'm gonna jump at it. But I'm pretty open. I'm gonna go home and relax, and you know, play in the snow in New York, and then go on the beach in LA and see some games. I'm going to the Duke Texas Tech game at the Garden on the 20th of this month with the Under Armour people. You know, I had a deal with Under Armour for my Maldives team, but now that my contract's over, they said we'll wait till your next team will sponsor. So that's pretty cool. I'm looking forward to that. So, you know, I don't know. I'm open to the answer.
Have suitcase, have coaching board, will travel.
Yeah, I got a couple of suitcases.
Well, Coach, we're really pleased that you took the time to stop by with us. Enjoy your Christmas back in the States. And we'll keep an eye, of course, as ever, on your exciting adventures and progress over around the world.
Mark, always a pleasure. Thank you, and Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to you, too.
Thank you. Well, that's it for this edition of the MVP Cast. My thanks to John Cofino for joining us. You can download this podcast and all the editions via Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, on Google Play, and whatever your podcast provider is. Or you can head to MVP247.com and go to the podcast page. Stay tuned for the next edition coming up soon. But for me, Mark Woods, for now, from the MVP Cast, it's goodbye.